I was just in Colorado in awe of the incredible mountains that we have. Now I'm back at this in New York City at the sea level and in this deep urban environment. The fact that we have both of those things in close proximity to each other is just an indication of how much humans can create and build, and so much of it is good, and we need it.
Welcome to List NB, the podcast that reckons it's time for a change. I'm Mark Steadman, and every week I bring on a guest, and together we collaborate to build a top five list on a topic they choose. This week, my guest is law professor and director of the Center for Urban Environmental Reform, Rebecca Bratsbys. Rebecca's written books and comics to help us understand what's happening to the world around us and what we can do about it. So together, we are building our top five list of ways we can actually make a difference.
When people think about protecting the environment, they typically think about wildlands, pristine lands, trees and bunnies. And I am all for protecting trees and bunnies. I really am. I love going to national parks. I really love the landscape that is less interfaced with human beings. But to think of that as land that is not managed by humans is to miss the point about what we're doing. I mean, first of all, most of that land was indigenous lands for centuries and was managed, the ecosystems there were managed by the indigenous people who lived on them. And we have this notion that they're somehow apart from humans and wild and pristine, and that is not an accurate representation. And I think it leads into a misunderstanding about what environmental protection is. The laws that we have are very much about protecting human beings. And people who live in cities, when they don't understand that our environmental laws are about making sure that they have clean air, clean water, and a healthful environment, they don't view it as something that they have a stake in. And as we're increasingly urban in the United States and around the world, and if urban people don't care about protecting the environment because they don't think that's about the places where they live, then we're really going to be in even more trouble than we are already. So I used to go into public schools around the city, and one of the questions I would always ask the students is, do you live in an environment? And there was always at least one kid who said no, because their vision of what the environment was a pristine place, not where they live. So anyway, I run the Center for Urban Environmental Reform. Our goal is to empower people living in cities to participate in decision-making about protecting their environments. And through that, through a ripple effect, to make better laws that are stronger and more protective.
What's wrong with the world? Why do we need to make a positive difference? What's wrong?
Well, there are a lot of different lenses by which you can answer that. So I'm an environmental law professor, so I'm going to focus on what's wrong with the world environmentally. I think that also ties into deeper questions about justice and equity. But what's wrong with the world is that we don't value functioning ecosystems and healthy people in our economic decision making. And so as a result, we have allowed manufacturers and corporate actors to treat our collective air that we need to breathe to live and our collective water that we need to drink and cook with and bathe as waste depositories for free. And so that means that in their economic decision-making about what to produce and how to produce it, they don't factor in the cost that they're imposing on the rest of us in terms of illness and destroyed ecosystems. And particularly, they're not considering that when those who are on the receiving ends of that pollution, on that polluted air, polluted water, are marginalized communities. It might be communities of color, they might be low-income communities, it might be indigenous communities, and they are communities that pretty much as a society we have designated to be sacrifice zones. So that's what's wrong, and that's what's wrong on an environmental level, an economic level, a political level, a social level, and we have to pick a place to start solving that, and I pick the environment.
fantastic. I think what I like about this is I feel like you and I are going to come at this problem from different angles in a really good way, because I think my list is very interpersonal, but I think there's a couple of points you've made there which really, for me, justify some of the choices that I've made in terms of how we make a difference. I might be thinking less about the environment, but just how do we create, and I slightly shudder using this word because it's been so overused, but how we make an impact, how we make affect, you know, with an A, and or how we affect things, I guess. And so that's sort of really where I'm spending a lot of my thought is around that sort of interpersonal stuff, so that we can reach greater empathy and so that we can actually care about the communities that we don't necessarily directly interact with. Excellent. And with that, then, would you please give me your number one way that we can actually make a positive difference?
Yeah. So this is a number one way that works, I think, in our respective countries, but it's very much going to depend on the political culture in the country that a listener lives in. But that is voting. Voting for people who care about the environment, who care about climate change, who care about families, who care about future generations. You know, protecting the environment has become an incredibly partisan issue here in the United States, but that's very new. The Clean Water Act, which was enacted in 1972, passed unanimously in the Senate. And in the House, it was by a 350-vote majority. So it was like 366 to 11. I might be getting those numbers exactly, you know, not exactly right. But the point is that this was consensus. No matter where you stood politically, everybody agreed on this. And in fact, as recently as 2016, which is, you know, not even a decade ago, an act to amend the Toxic Substance Control Act here in the United States to make it the way that we control toxic substances stronger passed the Senate unanimously. There's profound consensus that everybody has the right to breathe clean air, drink clean water, and live on land that isn't toxic. And we still agree to that. The problem is that our electoral system is so broken that that basic consensus that people have isn't being translated into what happens at the state or national level. And the only way to change that is to vote and to prioritize voting for people who care about these issues. Because once those people are in power, they can change the gerrymandering that has eliminated the ability for voters' preferences to actually be reflected in election outcomes.
What a perfect, perfect number one answer. Thank you. My number one is being willing to ask and not judge. I think so often we look at an argument, or we look at a group of people, we look at something that we don't necessarily fundamentally understand all that well. And then instead of seeking to understand it, seeking to sort of to find out what is happening to a community, why this thing is happening, who it's affecting, what we could do about it, we sort of dismiss and or we judge, and we especially do that when it comes to difference, and again, you know, things that aren't necessarily part of our lived experience. Obviously, not all of us. Every one of us is different, but I think there is a tendency, especially egged on by what I guess we would now call traditional media, which helps us draw these battle lines between people, and that's a theme that I'm going to return to. I think we need to do a lot more of going, huh, that's interesting, instead of folding our arms and going, well, that's nonsense, or, you know, yeah. So that's sort of where I come in at number one.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And it both flows into the idea of sort of being engaged as a citizen in voting, and also flows into my number two as well. I think that the idea that we need to be listeners is something we have lost. The idea that we can approach a question humbly, that we can say, you know what, I don't know everything, and what I know is important, but other people have different lived experiences, and perhaps we can learn from each other in a way that makes us both stronger. Now, you know, there are people you can't talk with, but but those are few and far between when you really sit down and listen genuinely, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like you can know fairly early on when those are the people that you can't reach?
I didn't used to feel that way. But again, we have such a hyper-polarized world right now, and we have these political movements that are arising that are really very extreme and are not about truth and are not about the public, but they're really about amassing private power, and they're almost cult-like in their approach. And when somebody isn't willing to think, you can't really talk with them. And when facts don't matter, like if it doesn't matter if it's true or not, then, you know, dialogue doesn't really have any meaning. But I don't think that's most people. I really don't. I think it's a very vocal contingent. But I think most people are confused. Most people are scared. Most people don't have a tremendous amount of time to invest in learning. That's one of the great privileges I have as a professor, is my job is to learn and to teach. So I get to wallow in nuance, which is what I love. But most people don't have time to do that, or necessarily the inclination to do that, and they don't have to.
What is your number two then, leading off the back of that?
So my number two is to get involved locally. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been issuing really dire warnings that are getting increasingly dire over time. Their 2021 assessment report stated that it is unequivocal that human activity is driving climate change. And just sort of a reminder, unequivocal means leaving no doubt, clear and unambiguous.
Thank you.
And yet we have this massive climate denial industry. Many of the same actors who funded climate denial are now shifting over to fund climate doom. Which is like, you know, game over. What's the point of fighting it? We can't do anything.
God.
And, you know, historian Rebecca Solnit wrote about that, and she called it surrendering in advance.
Mm.
And it's that kind of defeatism, that kind of doomism is very convenient for the people who are looking to maintain business as usual. And it's profoundly crippling to human beings, this feeling of despair. I mean, you hear young people talking about the climate anxiety they have, about their unwillingness to have families, about their fear about the future. And those fears are valid, but the opposite of despair is action. And the local sphere, right, it's one thing to think about, okay, you know, nations are negotiating through the United Nations. And that doesn't really seem like something that an individual could have much impact on. And it also doesn't seem like something would have much impact on individuals. But when you look, and the same thing can be true on the national level as well, but when you look below that to the provincial level, to the state level, to the really local level, to your city, you can have a tremendous amount of impact by joining a local organization, by going to public meetings and asking questions. Like, ask your elected officials or your appointed officials, what is our plan for flooding? What is our plan for heat? Because even like in the United States, there are places where it's illegal for the government to talk about climate change. Going back to that hyperpartisanship we were talking about. Can't use that phrase. But guess what? They still are experiencing extreme flooding. They're still experiencing extreme heat, and they need to deal with it. And the local level is the place where people look for help. And that's where people can actually make a difference by talking with their neighbors and with their representatives about what are we going to do? How are we going to maybe plan this highway bypass that we're about to build in a fashion that's going to make us more resilient rather than less resilient? There's a tremendous reservoir for taking steps to protect communities from heat and flooding. Going back to that first point about people agree that we should be able to breathe clean air. And local governments are often really strapped for resources. Sometimes they have part-time mayors or employees. So, you know, sharing resources with them, sharing ideas, sharing information, being willing to say, yes, I will volunteer to be part of a task force or I will come to a meeting can really make a difference. And it helps you not feel despair because you can see, I did this thing. I made this change. And, you know, it's a little change. It's not going to solve the whole problem. But if we have enough people making those little changes, that adds up to big change. And that adds up to systemic change.
I can feel myself being stirred. I'm not gonna lie to you, Rebecca. I'm feeling stirred.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a good thing. It's definitely a good thing. Because I galvanized, if you will. Because I was just as you were describing that, I was thinking about just something very small to do with where I live and I'm pretty sure that if I went along to a meeting, I would at least be able to have a voice. And there's also a thing I was reading in a book yesterday called Contagious about sort of along the bystander effect kind of lines, where if you see a bunch of people not behaving in the way that you would want, that doesn't mean that they disagree. Chances are they also believe the same thing as you do, but they also believe that no one believes the same thing as they do, so they're not acting. There was a thing about student binge drinking in a college in America, and a little bit like you described it, you know, everyone believes they should have clean air and not live on toxic land. When the students were polled individually, they all agreed they didn't really want to drink a ton. But when they were at parties, they were around other people who were drinking more. And it's not because those other people wanted to drink more. It's because they believed that other people wanted to drink more. And so I think there's a real thing here about, like, go to the meetings, turn up for the meetings, and maybe you can be that voice that other people absolutely harbor, but are assuming is going unsaid purely by the fact that it's going unsaid, which is annoyingly circular, but I think is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it can be frightening to go to a meeting and stand up. I mean, I'm a professor. I talk all the time. I'm used to it. But I know one of the things I do is I help support people as they're trying to prepare a testimony for a meeting and, you know, coming in with a written thing that they're going to read, speak so that it's less anxiety provoking for them. You don't have to start there. You could start smaller. Like, go to a cleanup. Here in the United States, and I'm sure you do this as well, we have community days where people get together to clean up a stream or to clean up a roadside. And that can be a great place to start these conversations. You meet other people who care. And many of them will be very different from you. You know, a lot of deeply religious groups that you wouldn't think necessarily are going to be allies in this fight, they care a lot about their community. So they show up for these meetings and you can talk to people in a very casual, informal way. And then when you go to the meeting, maybe you recognize some people. So it's not quite so scary.
Oh, that's perfect. Thank you. That's wonderful. I remain stirred. My number two is don't just practice empathy, but teach it. One of the things that I think I'm surprised by when I speak to younger people, and those could be people who are, you know, what we would canonically call kids in their, you know, maybe they're 9, 10, 11, even up to early sort of adulthood, 20s. I feel like there's not as much empathy as I would expect, because it feels like a lot of discourse, and, you know, as someone who is sort of maybe pathologically on the internet, it seems like a lot of discourse is around people, and I don't say this with any judgment, but people sort of policing or wanting to have a say in what other people say. And so that feels like it comes from a place of empathy. But then when I speak to individual people on that sort of, you know, local level, it doesn't necessarily feel like that is there. And that could be about tolerance of difference or understanding of other groups or, you know, those kinds of things. And I think when we are younger, it's much harder to be empathetic because our world is very small and we are trying to protect ourselves and look after ourselves. And we have our small units and we fear anything that is different. And obviously, you know, that's where that stuff comes from. But I think finding ways that we can teach as much empathy at an as early age as possible, I think would have a really interesting effect as society sort of grows.
Yeah, so, you know, we had a big political fight here in the United States about the word empathy. When President Obama appointed Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, first Latina woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court, really a brilliant jurist and scholar, but she had apparently the temerity to suggest that empathy was part of the judge's role, and that set off a firestorm. Which I didn't quite understand. It seemed like code words for other things. But I do agree with you that having a deep sense that other people are actually people and that our actions and words can wound other people in ways that we don't intend, and that thinking about what would it feel like to be on the receiving end of whatever the comment or conduct is, really does make a difference. But I think that kids have a natural sense of empathy. And I think that we teach it out of them. There's a lot of research about very small children, about toddlers, and how much empathy they have, which is a really different vision of the way we used to think about toddlers, which was, you know, all self all the time. And they have very little experience in the world. So everything gets filtered through them. And that's true for young people in general, just because you have to have enough experience to be able to step out of yourself and look at the world. But that capacity is there. And I think the inclination is there as well. It's just not necessarily cultivated the way that it could be.
Thank you very much. Yes, perfect. I didn't know what to say to come off the back of that. I was just, yeah, good. Yeah, excellent point. What is your number three, please?
Okay, I'm moving away from this sort of social interactions to something just really practical that individuals can do. With the caveat, we need systemic change, but we also need individual... And systemic change doesn't necessarily come from individuals changing their behavior, because the options that we're presented with need to change as well. But one of the things that individuals can do that will make a real difference is to make a choice to eat less meat. You don't have to become a vegetarian. I'm a vegetarian. I have been for a very long time, but you don't have to be. But just making the choice to be more conscious about your consumption of meat, particularly beef, makes a huge difference in terms of its climate impact and its environmental impact. Beef has the largest climate footprint of any food source, nearly 60 kilograms of carbon dioxide for every kilogram of meat that is produced. And every kilogram of meat that is produced is not how much is consumed. There's like a 40% loss along the way. And so by choosing, say, one day a week to have a meatless meal, you are reducing your impacts significantly. And the ways that this impacts the environment and the climate is that, first of all, cattle are ruminants. They produce methane through their digestion, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas. So that's sort of the first impact. The second impact is that we clear a lot of land, particularly forest land, to turn it into grazing and cropland. In the United States, 40% of our corn crop is for animal feed. And that is true in many places around the world, right? We're clearing land to grow crops, to feed the cattle. It's a hugely inefficient way to feed people in a world where we have 800 million people who don't have enough food. That's about 1 in 9 people. And then we also coat that land that we have just cleared, keep cleared, with nitrogen fertilizers to make sure those crops grow. And nitrogen fertilizers not only pollute our waterways, causing algal blooms, which use up all the oxygen in the water and kill fish, but they also release nitrogen oxides, which are pollutants that cause all kinds of human health issues, as well as climate effects, and carbon dioxide, of course, which is the main driver of climate change. So by reducing one's participation in that, I'm not saying everybody should become a vegetarian today or tomorrow, but if everybody just is more mindful about their eating and says, you know what, I'm going to take steps to reduce my impacts and still enjoy the food I love, but make choices about it, then we can collectively make a big change.
I was having a thought yesterday, and it only really, it seems silly. You know, a lot of these thoughts, you sort of have them and you go, I can't believe I didn't think that earlier. But I was listening to a podcast, and there's been some people I've followed online who do sort of competitive eating. And it was only just, I just had this unbidden thought of, oh yeah, no, that's really, that's sort of an appalling thing that we do. But we have these food challenges and see how much food you can eat from this, you know, not even thinking about the waste, but just the, yeah, just what that says. And I had this idea, and I don't know if I'll have executed on it by the time this episode goes out, but I quite like the idea of having a little web page somewhere where I just, you know, for people that I work with to sort of say, again, no judgment, but these are the things I believe, these are sort of my values, or you know, some things that I'm here for and that I'm not here for. And it's just like the first one that occurred to me was just like, competitive eating, that's it's very hard to justify that morally in today's climate.
Yeah, which doesn't mean that you can't like love food and have delicious meals.
No, absolutely.
I'm not the world's greatest cook, but I love to cook, and I love eating really yummy food. You know, I think a lot of people have this image that, well, if you're a vegetarian or vegan, it's because you don't really like eating. And, you know, there definitely is that sort of, here, have a bunch of vegetables that are maybe cooked, maybe not, but you can make delicious food, and it can be a real challenge, especially if you're into cooking. It can be a challenge. Say, how can I make something absolutely delicious with locally grown ingredients, seasonal ingredients, you know, and no animal products? And it's not hard to, I mean, it's not hard to do, and it's, you know, it challenges your palate in interesting ways.
Yeah. Absolutely. Some of the nicest food, I mean, it's one of those arguments, isn't it? Some of my best friends are black, but some of the nicest meals I've had have been vegetarian. I go to a business hippie festival thing, or have done for the last 2 years, and I'll be there again this year. And they always serve vegan or vegetarian food, and it is absolutely delicious. And you know, if you give me a various different types of bean, I will be fairly happy, because I love a bean. You know, it creates its own methane problems, but apart from that, you know, it's good stuff. Thank you for that. That's wonderful. My number three then is to watch Monty Python's argument sketch. And what I mean by that is, don't just take up contrary positions, but actually make an argument. So especially, you know, if we go back to thinking about climate change and ways that we want to change people's minds or help people along a certain path of thinking, we don't do that by just simply taking up a contrary position. We need to actually make an argument. We need to state our case. And that sometimes means stopping and listening for the other person to make their point, so that you can add to the argument. You know, my friend of mine years ago helped me understand this whole, you know, we have the thesis, the antithesis, and then in the middle is the synthesis, and that should be what we should be aiming at if we're trying to get to a greater understanding. And we don't do that if we simply just cross our arms and say, no, it isn't. And so that's a very small, very quick point for me, is to actually make an argument, don't just have an argument. And with that then, short and sweet, that one, what is your number four?
Again, I'm sort of focusing on practical things that people can do.
Good, I'm glad one of us is.
In their daily lives. And that is to think carefully about their personal habits, their consumption habits, especially around plastic. Single-use plastic is a global crisis. Again, it's a structural problem that requires a structural solution. And in fact, the United Nations is in the process of negotiating a global plastics treaty to sort of create standards for regulating production and consumption. And that will hopefully include bans and phase downs and management of risk. But individuals, in the meantime, can significantly reduce their own plastics footprint just by carrying a reusable shopping bag and carrying a water bottle. And, you know, it's cheaper to carry a water bottle as well as, so it's like a win-win. as well as way better for the environment. You know, we produce 450 million tons of plastic a year, and most of it winds up in landfills or in the ocean. The production of plastics is extremely polluting. And again, that is a land use that is concentrated mostly in minority communities, in marginalized communities. And it has tremendous negative health impacts on the people who live around those facilities. So the production of all this plastic is very bad for the environment and for people. And then the disposal of this plastic is also very bad for the environment and people, and particularly for marine animals. Marine animals, marine mammals. When I was in the Galapagos, I saw a sea lion that had its head stuck in a bag, and there was absolutely, you know, its neck stuck in a bag. And as it was growing, it was getting tight, and there was nothing we could do to rescue that animal. And animals get stuck in, entangled in discarded plastic all the time. They mistake it for food and eat it, and it kills them. This is, you know, if you care, like one of the things that people care about a lot in general, people in the public care about a lot is sort of charismatic animals like dolphins and turtles and whales. And I care about them too. But that can be a way in to thinking about this, because those are the animals that mistake plastic for food in the environment. And then, of course, drinking out of plastic bottles is bad for people as well, because all kinds of chemicals leach into the water, and we're drinking that, and we're consuming that, and it's in our bodies. So avoiding using plastic is a win-win-win. It's better for you. It's better for the people who live around the production sites, and it's better for the environment and the marine animals.
100%. It's so easy. It is so easy for us to do those little things. I know some of it may be harder, but you know, if you go anywhere, if you travel anywhere, if you get, you know, tip listener, if you are not already aware, if you go to a coffee shop, they will refill your cup. If you bring your own cup, they will ask you, they might ask you to open the lid, but they will, you know, whatever drink you want, they will put it in your cup for you. You don't have to get a plastic cup. And it's, you know, it's really not that big a deal to carry a cup with you if you know you're going to be out and about. So like, I know it's small things, but you know, if at least it gets you into the habit of thinking about what's the next thing you can do. Once that becomes the norm, then it becomes easier to think about, well, what's the next step I could take, I guess.
Yeah. And just a tip, one thing that I did that made this much easier for me is I just have a reusable coffee cup in my suitcase. It lives there. And I have a water bottle in my carry-on bag, empty, because otherwise they take it from you at
customs
or airport security.
Yes.
But if you just sort of have it there, so it's always there, you don't have to remember, oh, I'm going to bring this with me, because it's just in your kit waiting for when you go. It makes it much easier to do this in practice.
So my next one is to investigate what people tell you about large groups of people that they don't actually work with. So I've been thinking a lot more about theys and thems, and I don't mean the pronouns specifically. I mean when we other people. And again, with two countries that are in election cycles and important ones, there is so often so much on certain sides of certain aisles. There is often so much othering that is done. One of the parties that is vying for consideration at the moment has made its whole thing about how it can take a group of people, treat them as one homogenous blob, and actually I understand that Trump is doing the same thing, because Trump and Nigel Farage borrow from the same playbook. Taking a group of people and assigning a bunch of characteristics to them that, you know, in this mistaken belief, or not even belief, but the narrative that they all think and act and believe the same things and they act together, it makes it very easy then for people to say, well, you know, these people do this thing, and I'm so much less interested in the idea of a they or a them, put me in touch with a person in whatever community, whatever group, I want to meet the people. And I think that is, that sometimes gets maligned and perhaps misunderstood. You know, there's the idea, like I made the joke earlier, like some of my best friends are black. There is sometimes, I think, we don't necessarily think about larger groups of people, but the people on our doorstep are the people that we have better relationships with. And that can get misconstrued or misconstrued and misused. But I think there is a positive way of thinking about that, in which really it is about, like acting locally, it is about the people around you, the individuals around you. Those are the people who maybe make up these demographics that we're talking about, but you can't influence a demographic. Well, not even influence. You can't learn from a demographic because they don't really exist. You have to, if you want to be expanded, if you want to continue and learn and grow, you've got to learn from individuals and share with their experience. And we don't do that by creating these homogenous groups.
Yeah, and that goes back to your point about empathy as well, right? The idea that other people are actually people, and that whatever label you slap on a group, that group is actually composed of people who are complex, who have children that they love, who have aspirations in the world. And they're probably not very different from your aspirations. Most people's aspirations are about making a better life for their children. And, I live in Queens in New York City. It is the most diverse place on the planet. And one of the things I love about living here is, aside from the fact that everybody brings their cuisine with them, and so we have this incredible food culture here, but we have a community that is based on respecting each other's difference and recognizing each other's difference and celebrating it and learning from each other. And that is what makes New York City a place that people want to come to, because whoever you are, there's room for you here. And, you know, I think that the world should be like that. Whoever you are, there's room for you. And this idea, this protectionism of we need to keep them out, with them in quotes, as you know, you can fill in the blank who they are, it changes over time, but almost invariably it is people who have been historically marginalized in some fashion, either racially or economically. And the stories get told about them that are just a tool to an end. It goes back to my point earlier about people not caring about truth, because they're just about power and about cult-like allegiance
and stories.
And I think that stories that are not about understanding. Like, stories can be an incredibly powerful tool for learning and understanding, but they also can be a tool that is deployed to prevent learning and understanding. And I agree with you that in thinking carefully about what stories were being told and who's telling them and why is very important.
Thank you. What is your number five?
So my number five builds on that. Be a lifelong learner. I think about it in terms of the environment, but it's true beyond that. Read things that are fiction and nonfiction. There are fantastic books that have been written about the climate crisis that we face, about the environmental crisis that we face. Some of them are fiction books, by Amitav Ghosh or Kim Stanley Robinson. Some are nonfiction. There's a really good book called Merchants of Doubt, which is about how the oil industry took a leaf out of the playbook of the tobacco industry and spent millions upon millions of dollars just trying to say, well, it's not proven yet. What we need is more study. But these books they're written for a popular audience. They're accessible. They're not like my law review articles, which I'm not going to recommend to people, even though I enjoy writing them and think they matter. Support education in public schools. If you don't have a book group, start one. And, read light fiction, read mystery novels by all means. Every now and then, mix in a more serious book and let it teach you.
John Runson, I think, is a very good gateway into that kind of world, because they are very sort of populist. Populist is probably the wrong word, but they are, you know, almost pop science. And you know, it's maybe an element of gonzo journalism, but they read very easily. But you do get to, I mean, you know, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I think is a really good example of that. But you know, you can also go in via The Men Who Stare at Goats and Them, and there's quite a few different things. And so, yeah, if you're not necessarily given towards nonfiction, starting with someone very accessible like John Ronson, I think is a good place to start.
Yeah, like it doesn't have to be boring and dense. It can be fun. It can be interesting. Like I recently wrote a book about New York City history, and it's grappling with really profound questions of who has the power to name things and what does it mean to say who gets to decide what counts as history. But it's also a really frivolous account of the people we name things for in the city, and it sort of uses the names of our roads and bridges as a way into that. So it's gossip on the most sort of popular level, but it also engages with really deep questions about who we are as a society. And there's a corollary to that, because I'm cheating. This is 5.1. You know, we need everybody. Think about your talents and how you can use whatever your talents are. Make art, write poems, go on hikes, do something that helps you both feel connected to the earth and to your society and to your community, but also it makes you feel like you're part of the solution. We need, you know, we need scientists, we need engineers, but we need artists, we need writers, we need people, we need teachers, we need nurses, we need people who are thinking about how can I use my talents to make things better.
Oh, there's me getting stirred again. yes, we're going to have a very good final list. Okay, my last one then, I'm going to go with spend your time and your thought around people, not systems. So I think this really, really does tie into some of the stuff that we're talking about here. So for me, systems and institutions, they create blockages. They create reasons why things can't happen, even at very, very simple local levels. I mean, Amazon doesn't necessarily do a great deal of good for the world, but one of the things that they do, which is counter to a lot of massive organizations, is they actually put you in touch with humans, and it's very rare. If I think about, you know, I'm traveling tomorrow, and I'm waiting on stuff to be delivered for my cats, so I can make sure they're all fed, and that. It just apparently isn't arriving today. There's no real explanation and no way of me being able to contact the courier, because their business model does not really allow for any kind of customer service. They have a thing that pretends to be a chatbot, and then it's just lots of buttons that take you through their equivalent of a telephone tree, but there is no way that you can mash on the keypad and say, get me to a human. So we all encounter this on individual levels at lots of times in our lives. And so my take on this is to gum up the works, is to always ask to speak to the human. You don't have to be you don't have to always speak to the manager, but always look for the human around a system. Anytime you encounter a system, try and find out, again, to some of the points that we've been making earlier, I think try and find out who are the people that you can, not who are not necessarily in charge, because again, to empathy, they may be a little bit more disconnected from that system, but at least find a way in. Find someone that you can talk to. I love the point that you made earlier about when we were talking about acting locally. It doesn't have to be about turning up to the meeting. It could be about turning up to an activity, and then maybe when you go to a meeting, maybe you've met someone there who is either influential or can be helpful, or at least supportive, or you know, someone that you already recognize. And so whenever you find systems, try and find ways to, if not smash them, because that's probably difficult, then at least gum up the works and make those systems grind down so they have to deal with us as human beings.
Can I add one little bit to that? Is remember that the person on the other end is a person. I mean, I watch people scream at service workers who are probably paid minimum wage, who have no control over the outcome, but could maybe help you a little bit if you were nice to them, or at least you could have a pleasant interaction out of it, because they're probably sorry that you're going through whatever you're going through. So that idea that I am actually engaging with a person who is another person who has feelings and emotions and is probably as frustrated as I am with the system. And maybe we can build empathy about our shared frustration about the system that will lead to some kind of change.
What a guest we have in Rebecca. Fantastic. Thank you to Rebecca Bratzbees for joining me on this episode. Of course, in just a moment, we'll finish our list. This one, bit more of a serious episode, you know, a little bit, the tone's a bit different. This is not quite Ways to Eat Potatoes or Top 5 Haunted Places, but absolutely worth us talking about. I think I did the hand slapping thing again. Listen, like, in 2 days' time here in the UK, as this episode goes out, we're going to be taken to the polls. We're going to be standing in a primary school somewhere with a pencil in our hand, putting an X next to someone's name. And I'm not going to tell you how to vote, who to vote for, that you should vote, anything like that. I'm just, you know, you've heard it all. I don't think a weekly podcast that gets... I nearly divulged my numbers there, but not very many downloads. I don't think a very niche podcast is going to be the one thing that you're like, you know what? I like everything that Mark does, and I've been listening for all this time, but I was always going to vote Tory, and now he convinced me that I should vote Labour. So I'm no. Stuff's going to get weird for a while, and stuff isn't going to magically get better. Yes, sure, we're pretty sure Labour's going to get in. But, you know, let's temper our expectations and let's do what we can do to start rebuilding this country, knowing hopefully that we are building it in the image of the idea of for the many rather than for the few. You know, I think there's I've had a resentment of this idea that we should all chip in when the people at the top telling us that we should all chip in have never worked a day in their life. I don't resent being told to chip in by someone who's maybe had a bit of work experience and has worked their way up. It's not a question of wealth, it's a question of do you have any sense of what the world is like? And I feel far more galvanized into action knowing that what I do might make a difference and is headed in the right direction. It's not going to be subsumed and it's not going to be made irrelevant because we're sort of doing the job that the government doesn't want to pay us to do or doesn't want to pay to be done. I feel like we are perhaps bringing in a government that wants to do these things, but we're not going to get them done because there's no money. So, yeah, stuff's going to get weird. Stuff's going to get confusing. I think there may be disillusion. Come on, bring it in for a landing, Mark. Make it light. Keep it light, eh, son? What? So it is, to a degree, on us to bring that, to make it all make sense, to look after our people, to look after the people around us, to focus on our Dunbar number, you know, the 150 people in our circle that we're around and we can help and we can affect, and do that knowing that if other people are doing their bit, it is going to make a difference. And we're not doing it knowing that that money is just going into a billionaire's pocket, but under the hope, under the... not necessarily proviso, but, you know, under the idea that it's actually making a difference. And you know what? If it doesn't make a systemic difference, something you do might make a difference to a person's life. And if we can affect one person's life, maybe one or two other people around the country or 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 or 1,000 can make those little ripples as well. And actually, we don't change a system. We just change lots of little lives by lots of little actions. That's maybe a thing that we can do. So, okay. All right. It's rein it in, Mark's final thought. let's get us back to the episode, eh? Let's get back to someone who actually knows what they're talking about. And let's complete our list, our top five list of ways we can actually make a difference. So I've been busy here creating a final list, and I don't see as much of my stuff on here as I might in other scenarios, and I think that's absolutely fine, because I think we've got some wonderfully practical things here, and I almost want to try to find a way to make each one an actual like action. But I think what we've got from 5 to 1, what I've got based on the conversations we've been having, number 5 is be a lifelong learner. Number 4, go meatless for a day. Number 3, teach empathy. 2 is vote. And then 1 I've written down as bring yourself to the party, because I'm thinking about acting locally in the way that you've described, but also the thing you shared in your last point about we need everybody. I think there's a show by Molly Wood called Everybody in the Pool, and I'm not sure I fully understood what that was about until now. You know why it's called that? It's because we need to bring ourselves to the party. We need to bring all of our creativity and our whatever we're good at, whatever we excel at, whatever we have a little talent at or an aptitude for or an interest in, bring that to whatever the party is, whether that is cleaning up your street or taking a wider action. And so that is what I'm thinking.
I think bringing yourself to the party is dead on. I think that is what was underlying everything that you said and everything that I said. So yes, that should be number 1.
Fantastic. So I will ask you then formally, Rebecca Bratsby's, do you consent to this list?
Yes, I do.
You mentioned that you had lots of things too many things to pull from. Was there anything else that sort of made your long list that we haven't discussed?
Again, it's always about making choices, but making choices about transportation is also a critical issue. You know, you don't have to be like all in, I'm only going to walk places, I'm only going to bike places, but try it sometimes. Take public transit one day a week, carpool every now and then, and maybe that will be the start of doing it all the time, but even doing it some of the time will make a big difference in terms of pollution, in terms of carbon footprint, in terms of noise, in terms of danger on the streets. So again, these are actions that you can take. And also, if you have the opportunity, plant a tree, have a garden, plant flowers that are good for pollinators. Just do your bit to make your little patch where you are greener and healthier.
And if nothing else, do it for the smug self-satisfaction that you get, you know? Yeah. Because if we think, going back to some of the previous points, like we are perhaps in some regard being made to believe that whatever we do is a drop in the ocean and it doesn't really matter. And so this way you get to say, yeah, well, at least I'm doing something.
And I will send you a sticker. Do it and tell me, and I will send you a sticker. You will get a gold star.
I like to be told that I'm a good boy. So, you know, that's perfect.
Everybody wants a sticker.
Of course they do. Magnificent. Well, Rebecca, where can people keep up with the work that you're doing?
Well, I have a website. It's just my name, RebeccaBratsby's.com. Most of my work is there, including the environmental justice comic books that I made that are available for free download for anybody who wants to use them for a nonprofit or educational use. I'm also on social media, typically as R. Bratsby's. You can find me anywhere. If you want to email me, look on my school website and you'll find my email address. I welcome comments and conversation.
Fantastic. This has been a real pleasure and a delight. And I feel fired up. So I hope you are feeling a drop of that too, listener. Rebecca, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.